Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, July 18th, 1998. In the fireside room this evening is Al Trost. Session number is 98-5 and is titled Immigration and Refugee Challenges. Let's listen in.
Well, we should end just at an hour. I have to tell the tape ministry that it's time to roll the tape. Last week, and not many of you were here last week, but I was talking about religion and politics in various national settings, and tonight I'm moving to, because we get off one week, or one day next week, Thursday is Jubilee Day, and there are no classes, so my five little presentations on global issues begins tonight. And I want to talk a bit about immigration or migration and refugee problems in the world. This is a topic that is overwhelming as you consider it from the standpoint, for instance, of the United Nations High Commissioner on Refugees, who is the UN official and agency responsible for handling migration problems. It is a hot political issue, as you know, in the United States. If you live in California, you know that in the last three or four elections, there's been a referendum on the ballot that put a question to the voters in California to, in some way, either restrict the immigrants coming to California, or to restrict the services that the immigrants receive, education and welfare services. Also a highly symbolic issue, although not doesn't mean much in practice, of declaring English as the official language of the state of California. So this is a kind of restrictive policy towards immigration and refugees that is in fact going on in many countries. I visited Germany in the March of this year, and the Germans who are going through a restriction of their refugee policy. The Germans have, because of the guilt, national guilt over the Holocaust, the Germans have had one of the world's most open refugee policies. But they are beginning to restrict that now, cutting it down so that people don't automatically have a right to live in Germany. They have a right to claim asylum. I'll get into some of that process and procedure in a few minutes. But this is around the world in developed countries a very hot political topic. The really kind of tragic circumstance in all of this is that as the policies of immigration get more toward immigration get more restrictive in the developed countries, the migration pressures actually are increasing. I think the tragedy, the kind of main tragedy over the last three or four years, has been the ethnic conflict in Rwanda and Burundi in Central Africa, which has driven of hundreds of thousands of refugees into neighboring countries, for instance, Zaire or Tanzania. And those countries are not really prepared to accept refugees or migrants. They're very poor countries to start with themselves. And I don't know if you remember from a year ago, this is cruel to introduce this into the Holden environment. But you may remember images on television of a year ago when Rwandan refugees especially were moving into Zaire and into Tanzania, only to be kind of driven back by the Zaire and Tanzanian armies and kind of forcing them back into Rwanda again, where they had good reason to expect that they would be killed or persecuted in some kind of serious way. So we have this kind of then real dilemma in international politics, growing pressure to migrate, and then on the other hand, less countries willing to receive. There are only three countries in the world right now that will take migrants on a permanent basis, unless there is some kind of extraordinary attribute to the migrant. A well-documented asylum case, for instance, that's something that a lot of countries still will take. But the only three that are open to non-refugee migrants right now are the United States, Australia, and Canada. So if you're, for instance, Irish or Polish or Algerian or Nicaraguan, the only places where you can have any kind of chance legally of residing permanently are those three countries. Now, many countries will take people claiming asylum. Many countries will take people in transit. But again, what we're talking about here is permanent residence, and those options are fairly limited. And both knowledge that that is the case in the United States Congress, and then things that happen in referendums in places like California, have made our politicians very conscious of not opening the gates too wide in the United States. In the 1980s, in the Reagan administration, the immigration policy was very restrictive. The Reagan administration brought it down to about 270,000 of people allowed in legally a year. The Clinton administration has bumped that back up again to about 700,000. This is in contrast to about 1 million who were left in the late 60s and early 70s. So we had a highly restrictive immigration policy in the 1980s, and it's been loosened up a bit in the 1990s, but there's a lot of fear. There was a man here who's a lawyer for the Immigration and Naturalization Service. He left today on the bus for Seattle, but he was talking about all the kind of restrictive atmosphere in which he has to operate in the INS right now because of political winds that are blowing. What I would like to do is to, first of all, give a little bit of background on policy here, especially in the United States, and then talk about some of the ethical questions that are raised by this, and then talk about what's being done right now to alleviate some of these problems, and then hopefully we'll have 15 or 20 minutes left for a discussion. First of all, the United States immigration law recognizes five categories of migrants to the United States. The first category are legally admitted immigrants and non-immigrants. These are people who show up at a port of entry, Chicago's O'Hare International Airport, and either present papers that they are being sponsored by a family member, or they are being asked to fill a job that an American citizen cannot fill, or that they are coming in on a contract labor basis, or that they are coming in under several special, what are called preference special equity categories. For instance, because Irish Americans are a very strong political group in the United States, Congress has, for the last 8 years or so, passed something called the Morrison Act, named after an Irish congressman from Long Island, which gives special exemption to migrants coming in, or immigrants coming in from Ireland. Much the same kind of thing has been done for Poland. So there are some countries that where the kind of lid has been taken off, but These are a person, in order to be admitted to the United States, has to fit one of those categories. And then the category that does not initially have to be documented is to ask for political asylum. If that is the case, if you come and ask for asylum at a port of entry, you will be detained by the Immigration and Naturalization Service. This means in Chicago that you're sent to a somewhat economical motel where they keep track of the comings and goings of the people until a hearing can be set before a hearing officer in order to say more about the case. Usually people who claim asylum will actually be in a kind of state of limbo for about a year in the United States before they actually come before a formal hearing officer and can apply for refugee status. Now, international law does not recognize the rights of people to migrate. It does recognize the rights of people who are refugees to claim asylum and to get permanent residence in a country. And to be a refugee, to get that status, you have to document that you are in fear of your life or your liberty if you are put on the plane and sent back to the place you came from. So that there are a lot of people who apply for asylum worldwide. Only about 20% of the people who apply for asylum get refugee status and are then allowed to apply for permanent residence in the country in which they've asked for asylum. So what that the whole picture here is, if you can look at it in kinds of streams or big movements going on, there are a lot of people who are moving. The problem is that they don't have places really to move to. There are about 18 million refugees in the world. There are about 16 million illegal immigrants that are that have gotten into a country without going through immigration at an airport or at a port of entry. And there are another 15 million people who are displaced persons in their own country. So, you know, if you add all of those figures together, you get about 50 million people around the world who want to move. Most of the people that we see in the United States are people who are moving for economic reasons. The Tutsi and Hutu refugees in Central Africa, I mean, they have no chance of paying for a passage to the United States. They are lucky to be able to get their belongings on their back and start walking. So we don't see those people. We don't see the people, if you look at your a little handout I gave here on international refugees and asylum seekers, you don't. We don't see Afghans in our country. We don't see people from Mozambique. Most of these people have everything they can do here to get out of a zone of danger and to get into a neighboring country. The country where people go is called, in international law, the country of first asylum. And one of the big legal or moral issues in the world is whether those countries have a right to do it or have the obligation, the responsibility of doing anything for the people who move in. Does Tanzania, for instance, have a right, or a responsibility to take the Tutsi or Hutu refugees? It's a dilemma that I'm sure you can understand. I mean, the per capita gross national product of a country like Tanzania or Zaire is slightly higher than the countries the refugees are coming from. This other place where there's a lot of problems right now in Africa is in Ethiopia and Sudan. And many of these people flee into Chad or flee south into Kenya, and again, the same problem. The Kenyans cannot deal with hundreds of thousands of refugees, for instance, coming in from Ethiopia. They can't handle it. And so, again, there's a kind of force repatriation of the people back to where they came from. We have the same thing, and some of you, especially those of you from Minnesota or maybe from the West Coast here, have kind of experienced further down the chain of this kind of process with the boat people from Indochina, right, where they get on a boat, sometimes drowning on the way or being captured by pirates leaving, especially Vietnam, and they'll make it finally, let's say, to Indonesia or to the Philippines. And again, those countries are very poor. What's typically happened in Southeast Asia, because there are so many international officials in the immigration area there, is that they have provided camps for the people, but the conditions in the camps are usually very bad, and most people can't live there over a long period of time. That is, their health will not take it. The boredom is terrific in these camps. The Filipinos, for instance, do not want Vietnamese or Chinese people scattering into the Philippines. They keep them very much contained in a very kind of small area here. And so there's boredom, there's no jobs in the refugee camps, and so usually the period of stay there that can be tolerated is 4 to 6 months. And then either they have to face repatriation back to the country they came from, or apply for asylum in another country. One of the problems, again, is that Australia, Canada, and the United States, which does have some room for these people, are too far away to be afforded very easily. And that's why those of you, again, who have been, especially in Lutheran churches in Minnesota, I know, has been very good in this, and that people from Southeast Asia have been sponsored by the congregation and brought to Minnesota, to Minneapolis or St. Cloud or wherever, and brought into the local community, trained in English and in some kind of skill, and then sponsored by the congregation. But that's the only chance, really, that most of these people have. Now, when I said that the United States admits about 750,000 people, that does not include refugees. Refugees are over and above that limit. There is no limit on refugees, although, again, we don't see many of those people except one category, Haitians. People from Haiti do come and usually land in Florida. This was more a problem under military governments than it is currently, but they come and land, and then they are put in a camp in Florida, and they apply then for refugee status, and the governments of both the Clinton administration and the previous Republican administrations have denied refugee status to the Haitians because they claim that they're leaving for economic reasons, and so therefore have to come under the 750,000 limit. Now, to get into the United States legally, and the same is true of Canada and Australia, preference is given to people who already have families living in the country. So what that means is that if you're Polish, for instance, and have a Polish wife or husband or a Polish father or mother living in the United States, those are called first preference immigrants. And there are about 400,000 of those people who qualify every year. So that's of the 750,000 who were admitted. 450,000 are immediately taken up by the family preference category. Second preference immigrants are relatives of families that can sponsor them economically, that can show that they can support the person coming in and can get them a job. Usually this means getting somebody who's operating a business or a shop or something to say, yes, we will hire the person coming in. This category it's got a very kind of complicated, kind of technical name. These are people who are born of alien parents. Well, most immigrants are born of alien parents, so you know, this is a category that actually could have millions of people in it, but again, the family has to show that they can provide a job. Well, this takes care of another 150,000 or so coming into the United States. And then the third preference category are skills that we need. And those of us who work around universities, or maybe, you know, you work for Boeing or Motorola, this is a kind of constant kind of individual case that you face. We always, when we advertise for a position at Valparaiso University, for instance, we'll have a number of foreign nationals apply for the position. And the job for us and for the university's immigration lawyer, if we want to keep this person, is to show that, again, an American is not a more suitable candidate for the position. And this is a difficult task often. For instance, we have a Chinese man right now who on our faculty, who's a violinist, and is teaching our Chinese courses for us. And he is a refugee from China. He was part of the democracy movement and cannot go back. He's been in the United States about 6 years. First he got on a student visa and renewed that as long as he could legitimately claim that status. Then we hired him. We can hire on what's called an H-1 visa, but this term runs out after a while, and he's now coming to the end of his eligibility for an H-1 visa. We thought that the combination of Chinese language proficiency and English proficiency and violinist was a unique thing, so we advertised in the Chronicle of Higher Education and a bunch of other people for Chinese people who could both speak Chinese, teach Chinese to English students, and play the violin, and we got 380 applicants. So, you know, Mr. Meng has thrown in the towel on this. And, I mean, he is literally facing deportation this year. He's got a strategy. He's given up on the American lawyer and has hired a Chinese lawyer, and he thinks he can get him one more year of a student visa, but that what he would do accomplish by doing that is to prolong his stay in the United States so his son can complete a second year in American university. And then beyond that, hope that the restrictions on China are relaxed a little bit. China is an unusual case because of the democracy movement and the persecution of students there and dissidents. So, you know, if the Chinese government cracks down on the dissidents, there usually is a batch of resolutions floating around Congress, you know, to let more Chinese in. And this has, in fact, been a liberalization for a couple of the past years. It is not currently in effect, but that's kind of his hope and chance. Since this is one of the cases that, you know, as dean I deal with, and I've gotten to know Mr. Meng, and, you know, to make matters worse, he's given free Chinese lessons to one of my sons. I don't think, you know, this was a quid pro quo on his part. I think he, you know, was doing, he's a very nice man. Our students love him. You know, they think he's really great. But this is the kind of, again, the dilemma. You know, you cannot say that the government is heartless here. What the government is doing is responding to political pressure. But again, this will work a real hardship. My guess is that if Mr. Meng is sent back to China, he will probably be at least restricted in his freedom, if not imprisoned, if he goes back. That is, I think, the most likely thing right now, since China wants to set a good record for better relations with the United States. My guess is he'll be restricted to his village or his neighborhood, and they probably will do no more to him than that. But again, this is one case, but it shows the difficulty of working with the law. Now, I've been, I suppose, in a sense, a little critical of the American policy here as I've been talking. Actually, if one wants to get really aggravated about this, you need to go to Europe or Japan, where the idea is to protect what is essentially a homogeneous society. And this is perhaps most glaring in the Japanese case. They refused asylum to many of the people from Southeast Asia. They would let them stay for a week or two till they could arrange transit to some other place, but very few people are able to successfully achieve immigration status in Japan. The Europeans, and this is one of the things I have known for a long time, but again, going there right when this was coming up to the Bundestag in March of this year, one can see it. Beyond the legal categories of being an asylum petitioner or being a refugee, the Europeans have a kind of special understanding of their country. And even though you might achieve citizenship, for instance, in Germany or in France, you still are not accepted as a member of the society, which is not a legal thing. And so this is the dilemma. Again, some of you who have traveled in Germany or France see this. You see the kind of graphic evidence of it as you walk around the big cities. There are people who are there with legal documentation and papers, but they are really not brought in to German society or to French society. In fact, the more they're visible, the more they're kind of rejected and put out in the train stations. This is where they usually hang out in Germany. The more they become an irritant. And again, the German politicians trying to win re-election and whatever have become much more and more restrictive about this kind of thing. Groups also, I should say this, that have had a history of immigration to a place, of course, have an advantage. Because if you have family members, you can bring other family members in. And this became such a problem with the American immigration law the last 2 years, that is fiscal 96 and 97, that Congress passed a special limit on Indian people from India. Because so many Indians were already here that if they would give preference to family members of Indians, they would have filled most of the total quota. And so, and of course, this has damaged our relations with India and with other South Asian nations because we have had to do this. But a limit was placed for that country. We've tried to get away from national quotas for the most part. Are there any questions about the kind of legal things there? Yes?
We just mentioned quotas. There are still some quotas, aren't there? Which immigrants do those apply to? Mm-hmm.
Yes, yeah. The main category for that are employment preferences for the quotas. The present immigration law says that a spouse or a child has to be allowed into the country. That's the present immigration law. So there are, except for India, and there's one other country, I can't remember what it is now. If I thought a minute, but I don't have time really to go through the list of countries here in my mind, but there's one other country that has a limited post on it right now. But for employment preferences, there are national limits. This has been a case, especially again with my Chinese colleague, because there is a limit of 10,000 Chinese coming in under employment preferences right now. And most of you live up here in the Northwest and know that this is a very significant population group up here. So there are a lot of Chinese people already, and this is an attempt to kind of restrict this. The man who was here said that sometimes he operated out of the Seattle office, that this looks like a return to the old Asian Exclusion Act that the United States used to have in the 1920s, where we had immigration policy toward European countries that, you know, had national quotas but tried to be fair, but then Asians were excluded, Chinese especially were excluded from coming under those quotas.
I have two short questions. Yeah. Can marriage then be used as a means of gaining entry for a foreigner to marry an American citizen?
If you're already married, it can be, yes. I mean, if you marry in another country, or you were living in another country, but you were an American citizen and you come to the United States, then your spouse can follow you to the United States. Oh. Now, we're not talking about citizenship here. We're talking about being in the United States legally.
To live.
To live.
And is there any limit, any time limit on that then?
It depends what kind of what visa conditions. There is a visa status known as permanent resident, which is short of citizenship. And you can live permanently in the United States under that. Most of the others, the student visa, the H-1 visa, have limits on them. And so, you know, after the time has passed, I mean, they're essentially given for temporary reasons, for going to school, for instance, or for seeking some kind of employment experience so you can go back to your own country.
And is torture under liberty, or is that a separate category?
Well, that's under liberty, mm-hmm. Yeah. If you can document that you would face torture going back to your country, that's a good case for claiming asylum, certainly. Mm-hmm. I don't know, have any of you ever been to one of the camps or on the Mexican border? We actually maintain what are essentially prisons. They're not maximum security prisons. They're certainly minimum security prisons to house mainly refugees. The Mexican migrants, as you probably know, are sent back across the border on buses, usually within a couple of days. But these are people from El Salvador, Guatemala, or Honduras, or Nicaragua, Colombia. When they come into the United States and either are captured because they're in illegally or because they have applied for asylum but their case is pending, they are put into what is essentially a prison. These are Latin Americans that face this. A couple years ago, I won't say it was a privilege in a way, because it's something I would never have seen ordinarily, but I visited a couple of these along the Mexican border. These are people waiting for their refugee hearing to come up, but they don't want them melding in with the problem here is melding in with the Mexican population in the United States and being hard to find, so they have incarcerated them. The prisons are run by the Immigration and Naturalization Service under contract to private corporation that runs prisons. This is happening anyway for just the ordinary person convicted of a crime in the United States. More and more prisons are run by private corporations. Government is gradually pulling out of that business. But these are all of the INS prisons are run by camps, they call them, detention camps. They're minimum security, though. I mean, you have to go in, you're patted down when you go in, you have to walk through sensors. The people are essentially locked in their rooms at night. So it's people who come to the United States under those conditions, you know, really want to be here. I mean, it bothered me, it bothered the people I was with during these things. We talked about it for a long time after this, you know, what this all meant and what we could do about it. Yes.
I'm sorry, I missed the very beginning, so you've probably already gone over this, but out of the 750,000 refugees accepted in a year...
These are migrants.
Migrants.
People coming in, trying to get in legally.
Mm-hmm. Right, okay. And how many apply per year on average? Or has it been increasing every year, so it's not... Is there roughly, say, what, 2 million?
Well, in the refugee category, about five times as many apply as get it.
Okay.
In the migrant, that's a hard figure to come up with.
Okay.
There are about, I hate to bombard you with these statistics without a handout or putting them on the board, so maybe I should limit myself after one or two more here. There are about 5 million uh-huh. illegal migrants in the United States right now. About 250 to 350,000 new ones come in every year. Some of them, for instance, Mexicans, will go back across the border, and their intention, often in the long term, is to go back to Mexico. But there are about 5 million, and we shouldn't just think of Mexicans here. I mean, this is not the only category around us. In Valparaiso, there are a number of Polish illegals. From time to time, you know, one will be caught speeding on the tollway or something, you know, and they'll be in this country illegally. They come in initially as tourists on a tourist visa or a student visa, and then kind of get lost in the Polish-American population in Chicago or do some kind of migrant labor someplace. So.
Two questions. One, I wondered the role of the United Nations in this. And then secondly, when the political climate's changed, like in the Vietnam, is there tracking of those that wish to return and do return mm-hmm. to establish?
Yeah, not very good. It's one of the jobs that American embassies perform overseas, is to try to track people who have been repatriated back into the countries and to compile a record or a documentation on what happens to them. But if you're operating in an oppressive system anyway, I mean, it's very difficult for American officials to keep very good track of that. I mean, I think they probably know generally the fate of people who are sent back, but individual cases are very hard to track. What was your other question?
The United Nations.
The United Nations is in charge. The main category for most of the world are refugees and illegal migrants, because most countries do not accept migrants coming in, let's say, for economic reasons. This is not something that many countries of the world are concerned with. They're concerned with people who come in and they want to leave, or people who come in and claim refugee status. So the United Nations, the main agency, is called the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. It sounds like one person, but it's actually an office of a couple thousand people. And they're headquartered in Geneva, Switzerland. And for instance, in the Central African crisis, they will have people on the scene in Burundi and Rwanda and Tanzania and Zaire. Trying to keep tabs on all of this, trying to report on economic conditions as part of the United Nations machinery. They can go to another United Nations agency, for instance, the World Food Program, and ask for some emergency food help. That's an advantage the UN has. But the UN is a voluntary agency, and I mean, it's voluntary in the sense that people who comply with its orders do so on a voluntary basis. It has no sovereignty. It can't make anybody really do anything. So its clout is really in the fact that it's a global organization, international organization, and it's got some. It's conspicuous in people's eyes, and from that standpoint, it can be of some use. But no, that's all. It tries to monitor refugee situations. It tries to report on them. If they can find emergency help, for instance, in the Rwanda-Burundi crisis that ran especially through last year, they will solicit the help of, let's say, Lutheran relief services, or they will go to Catholic Relief Services or the Red Cross and try to talk them into giving more aid than they might ordinarily give. They try to then monitor the disbursement of that aid, but they're not supposed to be doing that themselves. They are only supposed to be monitoring the world refugee situation. There's also in another part of the UN a migration council that just collects statistics on migration trends, but it's not on the scene. It does not get into the trenches. So that's the UN's role, is basically being there, trying to maybe embarrass countries into doing the right thing through publicity, putting more pressure on non-governmental organizations like the Red Cross, like Oxfam and so forth, to get more help. Yes?
How many times can one renew H-1 visa? And also, is it possible to convert the H-1 visa to the permanent residence visa?
Yes. The way you can only do it under these categories I've talked about. Either a relative in the United States that's close, mother, father, or spouse.
Oh, sorry, I meant after you've been issued H-1 visa.
Oh, an H-1, you're talking about if you have the H-1 visa already?
Right.
Yes.
Can you renew it 3, 4, 5 times?
You can renew it 3 times, yes. Three times.
Which was the H-1?
Before you take more questions, could you finish off your main material and then we can ask them? We're not going to get down to the essence.
Okay. One way to look at migration is to look at what are called push and pull factors. And this is the kind of language or concepts that people who work in this area use. A push factor would be a war that's going on. Again, the ethnic violence in Burundi and Rwanda. That's a push factor. It pushes people out of the country. Another is hunger, starvation. Those are push factors. Plenty of them afoot in the world. Pull factors are the attractiveness of the place that the refugee or the migrant wants to go to. An obvious pull factor in the United States is the fact that there are a lot of stories afoot about how people who have come as migrants to the United States have made it economically, or even people who may not have struck it rich in any kind of obvious sense, that their plight is better off than the people who stay behind. This is a big factor in Mexican migration. People will have relatives in Chicago, or relatives in Denver, or relatives in New York City who report back that, yes, I'm on welfare, but you know, my kids have enough to eat, and we're getting health services and so forth. And this is a pull factor. And when you put both of those together, then you have the major migration patterns in the world. And one of the major ones, for instance, is from Afghanistan, which has had almost kind of permanent war for the last 12 years. From Afghanistan to the Persian Gulf states, where there, again, are attractive economic possibilities. So, there is a sense, I think, that, and this is not something that I would want you to go away with from here, because it's not an accurate picture, but there is a sense, I think, of people, especially those who live close to the Mexican border, that the United States is actually being overwhelmed by people coming in from the outside. And the numbers don't really support that. The official immigration policy of the United States, you know, doesn't facilitate that, doesn't make it easy for that to happen. And in the last census in 1990, when the census was taken, the census takers found about 6% of the American population had come in or were foreign born. And they found, of those people that were in the census, that about 78% of them were in the country with documentation. Now, the census did not allow census takers to report illegal status to the government. This was a part that was put on by Representative De Garza of Texas, who was a Mexican-American, and he made sure that the census takers would not police for the Immigration and Naturalization Service. So presumably there were still people who were foreign-born who were scared by census takers coming and knocking on the door, right, and, you know, asking, are you foreign-born or not? Having experience with bureaucracy in their own country, the likelihood is that they would not have probably been totally forthright in reporting that status. But that 6% is one of the lowest, considering that we're a country for migration. That's a pretty low percentage. Now, of course, in total numbers, it outdoes Australia and Canada. But as a percentage, we're under most other developed states. Even Germany and France, which have very restrictive immigration policies, the number of foreign-born, for instance, in France, that's foreign-born now means outside of the European Union, because anybody who's in the European Union can claim permanent residence in any other European Union country. But even considering that, about 8% of Germany's population right now is foreign-born, and they have a very restrictive policy. So it's not the case, and I mean, that's a very important thing to say. I mean, one of the things that we're supposed to be thinking about this summer at Holden Village is being hospitable, and I guess we're less inclined to be hospitable if we think people are taking something that we think is ours. And just in kind of the most simple matter here, in the simple, most simple perspective, this is not, we're not being flooded by immigrants. Now, again, you know, I suppose somebody who lives in South Central Los Angeles may have a little different perspective on that, because they're in a place where there's a lot of mixing of illegal and legal immigrants. But for the country at large, no. The other thing I wanted to do here was to just look briefly at the other two handouts I gave. One of the kind of world patterns that's going on is the big gap between standard of living in a country like the United States and Canada on the one hand, and countries in Africa and Latin America and Southern Asia on the other. And I mean, I'm not really into economics here tonight, but just to show you, yes, the one little bar graph that I handed out there is the gap between the Southern Hemisphere and the Northern Hemisphere as regards per capita incomes, and you can see that the gap is large. And one of the things that if you do this study, this kind of thing, the gap increases. So it's an increasing gap between rich and poor nations in terms here of standard of living. So the people who want to come to the United States, who want to come to the developed countries, I mean, they are making a judgment which, from their own point of view, from the point of view of their own interest, their own self-interest and the interest of their family, is an entirely rational decision. It's, you know, if you were in the Southern Hemisphere here and had an opportunity to go to another country where the chances for a comfortable living were better, where you didn't have to cope daily with whether you have enough food to eat or not for your family, the pull there is very significant. And the other one that I handed out here is crowding, which is another push factor. This is This is comparing the kind of population in developed countries with the less than developed. This is only using Europe because the statistics are better there. So there, there is space. In contrast to many of the countries that where there is this population pressure. One of the things that's happening, I really was not going to get a lot into migration patterns within countries, but I think, how many of you have been to Mexico City? Is anybody in here? This is a place where you see the effects of migration and then crowding. Mexico City's population is certainly over 20 million right now, and it probably is getting very close to 40 million people right now. And this is, again, the attraction of the city as a place where living conditions may be better than in the countryside. Objectively, it's probably not true. Because of, you know, when a Mexican stays in their own village, it is the village is going to watch out for them, is going to help them, is going to, you know, by kinship ties and that kind of thing, is going to take some responsibility for the person. But again, it's the pull factor of the city that brings the migrants to Mexico City, where then crowding becomes a problem, and so they go there for a better standard of living. They may find it slightly better, but then the crowding is so bad with the then problems of getting any kind of full-time permanent employment, and then that pushes the migrants on further north, where they the reason I put up the Latin American map here was just to say just a bit about that problem, and then they come, as you probably know, north to the border where. Usually American and other foreign corporations, sometimes even Mexican corporations, have a series of factories known as maquiladores. And, you know, their standard of living is better than it was in Mexico City, but successive groups of Mexicans come north to find jobs in the maquilador, which then exploits the fact that they have an overabundance of labor. Usually people work in those factories maybe 2 years or 3 years at a max. It's piecework for the most part, and the premium is put on how fast you can do this. So young men and women, you know, do it very well for 2 or 3 years, and then they begin to slow up. So they lose their job to somebody who's come up in another wave, and then they're at the border, and again, you get crowding. If you've ever been across the border at Laredo, for instance, to Nuevo Laredo, you see this again, the crowding, and that then pushes the Mexican migrants just in a struggle for life here, struggle for a better life to get across the border, many of them illegally into the United States. Well, I think I'll stop there. I've been a little on the gloomy side here, I guess, with this. Yes.
If you take an appropriately long perspective, that is 100 years or 300 years, can you see trends in migration patterns despite these huge push-pull spikes? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think there's one thing we can do something about, and that is to try to remove oppressive regimes. I think, you know, I mean, the track record, I'm going to be talking about this one night or one day next week, the trend toward democratization around the world right now. it now seems to be possible for the international community collectively to put enough pressure on countries to get them to remove some of the most oppressive political persecution. So I think that that would at least ease up on some of the refugee problems. Economic situations is a tougher one to deal with because, it's kind of easy to say, well, you know, if we could only bring Mexico, let's say, and Haiti up to a higher standard of living, then people wouldn't want to leave. Again, people have studied this empirically, statistically, and what they find is that, as a matter of fact, more people leave as the situation in Mexico is improving than would if the situation was entirely desperate. But what they have now is the wherewithal to, first of all, travel north. And they also now understand a bit about free enterprise system. They have acquired some skills, which they think will be marketable in the United States. So as Mexico's standard of living has increased, and it's moved in the United Nations category from what's called an LDC, less than developed country, into an NIC, a newly industrializing country. So that from the UN's perspective, it is now ready to launch as an industrialized state. And the migration has not slowed down from Mexico because of the NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, did not slow it down. I mean, this, some of the people who proposed that, I think it's a good thing, by the way, but a lot of people who proposed that said, well, this will improve Mexico's standard of living, and Mexicans will not want to come to the United States anymore. But as expectations rise, the migration actually increases. So that's not something we seem to be able to do or can do much about. And besides, there's not a great propensity to invest in third world countries in the United States so far. So, and I'm not sure that there's enough capital floating around there to do much for more than a few countries, a few select countries anyway. So, yes, Steve.
I was just wondering, often you hear there's a certain fear, like you said, of America being flooded by immigrants, and a common expression of that fear is this, that somehow it's hurting the economic situation of, you know, American citizens, whether by immigrants going on welfare or taking our jobs, and so to say. But I've heard as many arguments the other way, saying that, yes, no, it's right, a boost to the economy, you know, cheap labor, paying taxes, and the vast majority of them are skilled laborers and so forth. I don't know which.
Well, I think
you said a little bit about that, which is a misperception.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that actually they help. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it furthers the economy. I think 54 million migrants have come to the United States since 1820. Mm-hmm. And I mean, this is the kind of launching of the American economy. And obviously it was done, you know, with a big share by immigrants. No, I mean, there's an exploitative element to it, and, you know, if you could kind of lapse into kind of Marxist analysis of this, and these are the people who are most exploited in the society. I mean, obviously, a lot of American companies give employment to Mexicans, for instance, but then they don't pay them, especially if they're illegals. I mean, this is one of the reasons so many illegals are able to stay in the United States, is that employers will hire them because it's a good deal for them. You know, because they're illegal, they'll work for less, so they won't have their status reported. And so, yes, I mean, there's no question that migrants, at least the amount that we've been taking in, probably a good deal more than that, are good for the economy. That's what I would say. Dorothy, did you?
The other side of it is, if we skim off from less developed countries, their most technically trained and highly gifted people, well, that's an ethical dilemma. Just a week or two ago, we saw a documentary on TV in which it was stated that right now, at this moment, there are 250,000 jobs for computer astute people, and there aren't people to fill them. And they said if the immigration guidelines were relaxed, you know, we could bring in people for those jobs. Well, but they pointed out that's a dilemma. That's an ethical dilemma for us.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, you see that in hospitals and urban situations. You know, a lot of immigrant doctors are working there, you know, and, you know, would they, you know, is their obligation maybe back in their own countries? I don't know.
Congress recently raised the quota, which is exhausted for H1, I guess, is it?
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. Mm-hmm.
So there are none coming now, but in next year, yes. Quota.
Congress actually had to raise the whole immigration quota this year just because of the number of people that qualify again under family preference. So it was supposed to be 750,000, and they had to raise it to 937,000, I think, this year. Yes?
I'm troubled by doing illegal or unethical things for economic reasons. We've had the conditions, I think Washington, D.C. a lot, where people take in child care workers who were illegal immigrants for economic reasons. And I think it may be exploitive of those people, too, to take them in and pay them a lot less. Although it's illegal, it's very convenient. And, you know, a notable example, slavery, which maybe economically to advantage, but it's certainly more unethical.
Oh, sure.
And I have a real problem when we want to take people in because it stimulates our U.S. economy.
Well, I think, you know, those of us here as individuals, you know, should certainly think about, you know, hiring a person that's not here on legal status in our own job, in our own enterprises. But Steve's question was really about the economy, you know, is this good for the economy? And it is. But, you know, again, for individuals, and especially the group of cases you're talking about where government officials and congressmen were hiring illegals to babysit their children or be a nanny or whatever, I mean, that's a...
But how do we view doing something illegal because it's good for the economy? That's an important question.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we try to stem the tide of illegals. I mean, it's yes.
Do you see the church as having any special insights or a special role in this whole?
Yes, I certainly do. I think the whole trait of hospitality, welcoming people. I think that's what I saw happening very positively with the boat people. Actually, the social services for refugees and immigrants in the United States is mainly handled by the Catholic and Lutheran Refugee and Immigration Service. I mean, they're the ones that actually do most of the things that are not done by government. We could do a lot more. I mean, those parts of the church are dependent upon funds that go to the denomination usually, and maybe a special offering once a year. You know, you have a special envelope for Lutheran Refugee Services. But I think, they have been able to do things that the government has not been able to do in terms of mobilizing the support of the community for migrants and refugees. And I think that's a very important thing to do.
Did you talk about the church in the recipient countries?
In the recipient
countries. Now, what about the church in the donor countries?
I would, well, I'm trying to think of how this would work in places like Mexico, for instance, where I'm sure the church is stretched in terms of providing services to the people who are already there. And you know, certainly they can't do much to increase their standard of living. I mean, there's not that much money available. I guess I can't see that as clearly. Now, the Catholic Church especially has supplied a lot of foreign religious vocations to third world countries, especially from countries like Ireland and Poland, where there's an excess. And that there are a lot of people operating in Nicaragua and El Salvador and Mexico from European countries as kind of social welfare deliverers. Mexico forbids foreign missionaries to come in, but they will allow people to come in and operate social service agencies. So that's a handicap in that one country. But in El Salvador and Nicaragua, there are a lot of people coming in from the United States, and especially in official clergy kinds of positions. Yes, Paul, and then, yeah, you've had your kind of behind. Why don't we take those two questions and then stop?
Well, it seems to me that the church runs into its usual tension with the world here, in this case, a capitalist society whose driving motive is profit, and many ethical issues run into a dead end on that. When push comes to shove, the ideal of limiting our profits for ethical reasons is not often well received by those that we think should look at it more closely, and this would just be one example of that. It seems to me how the issue for the church is, how can we help our society deal more effectively with this tension between the profit motive and our ethical or value system?
Yes.
Or systems.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Which is not an easy thing.
No, it isn't.
There's no simple answer to it.
No, that's, I mean, I think that's at least one of the main elements in the dilemma, yes. And Catholic bishops tried to say something about that a couple of years ago, but I don't know what kind of effect it had. I don't think it was received as well as some of the other pronouncements they made. Yes?
A little intimidated by having the last question. I'm not sure if it's the best one, but...
Oh, that's...
What I was mostly curious about is, in the media, I don't hear very many positive things about the influx of illegal immigrants in our country. Whereas in this room, I'm hearing a lot of positive things. And so I'm wondering, is the media using the situation to create a story? Is this something that's largely manufactured by the media? Or is it certainly a problem, but just in the cities where the illegal immigrants are clustering? I'm confused as to the disparity in information.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that the media follows a story. There's a story in California politics here.
Big one.
I mean, the governor of...
And in Florida, and
yeah,
in New York,
Florida.
And in Texas, yeah.
Pete Wilson tried to launch a national political campaign on the basis of his stand on migrants.
So is this a problem, but just in those cities?
Well,
or is it not even really
a problem
problem of lack of jobs?
It's a problem that I think the United States has resources to handle. That's what I would say. I mean, it's certainly the reason there was a negative opinion in California is because it taxes the social service system, it taxes the education system. People have to, you know, raise their... have to have their taxes raised in order to do this, I suppose. Not by much, I wouldn't think, but...
But the story about us not having enough to go around is manufactured largely.
Well, this is something like the economic system. I mean, it's a little easier to get people on the bandwagon that the media is, you know, doing some distortion here. I mean, I think, you know, we all... The media, when it reports...
Not to put you on the spot,
no,
I'm just curious.
Well, you know, when the media reports, I was talking about this in another context last week. They are fighting for an audience, especially with the competition from cable TV. And they have to deliver news that's going to keep an audience. And it can't be too complicated. You know, if they would go into even, we simplified things right here, but people would walk away from the television set after 3 minutes of statistics, right?
Right.
You know, so they simplify it.